Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, how's the volume in your headphones today? Are you good?
No, turn it up, Jim. Bring the noise.
So, Patrick.
Yes, Jim.
You have a lot of records at your house.
I do.
And one of the things I think you like about music, and I like about music, is that you don't have to like just one kind of music, one style of music.
Right.
That really, what's great about it is you can explore lots of different ideas and styles and influences and textures and all of that, right? And hopefully get something out of it from somebody else's point of view, right? And so this week, as we're doing some album anniversaries and kind of getting caught up on some of that, we have three very, very different records.
I know,
right?
It's really great, from three different decades.
Right. So we did an album from 1968, The Byrds' Sweetheart of the Rodeo, which was a country rock album. 1978, we did Devo, their debut album, which is a new wave album. And now we're going up to 1988, so 30 years ago, Public Enemy.
Yeah.
It takes a nation of millions to hold us back, right?
Yeah, it's incredible, man. I think, you know, we were just talking about this before we turned the microphones on. You had this record playing upstairs, and it was just like Saturday, you're kind of chilling, and this record still sounds incredibly contemporary, even though it's 20 years old. You know, it's just, it was such a leap.
30 years old.
30 years old.
Yes.
Jesus. It's such an advancement in sound collage and just this dynamic thing that they put together that was way fresher than any other music I think that was being made at this time.
So here's the thing. I haven't listened to this in a long time.
Yeah.
And I, knowing that we were going to talk about it, I've been listening to it again over the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
I think it sounds better than a lot of albums put out today.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. It really does. It's fresher. It's smarter. It's more dense. There's more to discover. It's just like super, super incredible.
To the point where, like, how did they do it?
I don't know how they did it. There's been a lot of stuff written about it since then, obviously, and from 33 and a Third books to all kinds of articles and things like that. And I know Chuck D, the main singer and lyricist for Public Enemy, has talked a lot about the fact that they were on a mission to kind of, number one, top their debut album, Yo Bum Rush the Show, which was good, but it was kind of slow and boiling, and they wanted to speed all that up and make it happen faster. And yet they wanted to make a statement that rap music was as inventive and creative and intellectual as any other kind of music. You know, they didn't want people to think that it was just sort of some sort of inner city, you know, thing that can be put down as being simplistic and you know, very basic.
So we'll get to this in a little bit here, but I think, to me, this is almost like a line of demarcation. There's like,
oh, it is.
There's hip hop pre It Takes a Nation of Millions,
and then
post. I really think this kind of changed a lot in music. So what would be a good track to start off with here?
I think we got to go with Night of Living Bassheads, because it's pretty much got everything that encompasses why this album's so great.
Here it is, bam, and you say, God damn, this is a dope jam, but let's define the term called dope, and you're thinking me funky now, no, here is a true tale, why the ones that deal, all the ones that fail, you can move if you want to move, what it prove, it's here like the groove, the problem is this. We gotta fix it, check out the justice and how they run it. Selling, smelling, sniffing, riffing, and brothers trying to get swift in. Selling their own, rob a home, while some shrivel a bone, like comatose walking around. Please don't confuse this with the sound. I'm talking about
bass, 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 bass.
Come on.
What's the night?
Bass, bass, bass.
What's the night?
Bass, bass.
What's the night?
Yeah.
Bass, bass, bass.
What's the night? Together to the bells of those that boost the dose of lack of.
All right, there's a lot in there.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Not only drawing, you know, sampling from other artists, but even like sampling themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
You hear stuff that's little bits from other songs.
That's
on this
incredible.
Record.
It really is. Yeah. And obviously there's a James Brown sample in there that's kind of a big hook, but there's also a lot of little stuff that's buried in there. These songs were so dense and so packed.
Dense is exactly the right word.
There's just no Like, there's no little sonic space that the Bomb Squad, which was kind of their production team, didn't pack with stuff. And it was interesting to me learning a little bit about this album. And you mentioned Brian Wilson earlier in the week. The Bomb Squad, you know, the main guys that were working on this for Public Enemy, Hank Shockley and Eric Sadler, while Chuck and Flavor Flav were doing live shows, they'd be back in the studio, like, putting this stuff together. It's kind of incredible. You know, like Brian Wilson, like, they were assembling these samples minute by minute and section by section. Yeah. And I just think it's just, I don't know, it's hard to put into words how incredibly fresh and different it sounded.
But apparently the live shows were a big influence on this record.
That's
because
right.
what they were finding was that people were really responding to the faster stuff that they were doing live. And so they wanted to capture that on record in some way. So,
and you know, it's interesting. I was lucky enough to see them play in 1989, in the winter of 1989, not too long after this came out. And I wasn't, you know, I don't know if I'd ever seen a rap show before. Probably never had. You know, being a white kid from the suburbs and going to the 930 Club to see a lot of indie rock bands and punk rock bands. And it was different for me to kind of grasp it. And they had, like, some of it was a distraction with, like, Professor Griff and the S1Ws.
Right.
They sort of had a little marching thing that they did with their berets and their military, you know, kind of thing that was distracting. But just to hear Chuck rap was incredible. But yeah, it felt more like a punk show because of the fact that the samples were so fast and they were so dense and loud and kind of coming from everywhere. And you know, they had Terminator X there playing, and Flavor Flav was kind of fun to watch. But it was a little more than I could really handle mind-wise, you know, and I was much more comfortable kind of listening to the record and pulling that apart, to be completely honest. Although I got to say, I think for at that time, that's probably to this day the show that I've been to that was most divided, equally divided along racial and gender lines. Like, there was a ton of white women, men, and black women and men at that concert. It was pretty incredible.
One thing about Public Enemy, they were, in terms of like the social commentary on this record, and especially with this record, right? They were really, in some ways, obviously, even the title of it, it was sort of a call to action for Black America, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And that we're tired of being treated this way, and, you know, it's time for us to fight back in some way, right? And although I will say that the sentiment of it, when you really listen to it, though, is fairly optimistic in that way.
It really
it's a sense of like, if we take control of things, we, you know, we can make a change.
Yep.
So there's that. But also, but because of the sound of the record, not necessarily the themes of the record, but just the sound of it, it became almost immediately embraced by white suburban America. Who, in their mind, so if somebody like you going to see like Fugazi and stuff like that,
that
Minor Threat, and to kids who were, you know, kind of into that, the underground punk scene or maybe like the thrash scene or something like that, they immediately got the same kind of sense out of this music, that sense of rebellion, that sense of like, you know, that fight mentality, that, you know, sticking it to, you know, the politicians, corporate America, whatever it may be, all the forces that sort of like keep you down in some way, right? And so there was a I think almost immediately sort of like a kinship between Public Enemy and some of these bands too, like Anthrax was a band that they connected with like right away, right? So there's that. But I want to get into a little bit about sort of like the evolution of hip hop a little bit.
Okay.
And I'm not going to sit here, kind of like you were alluding to here, I'm not going to sit here and say I'm an expert on this.
Right.
So just take this for what it's worth as a music fan who, you know, wants to understand these things better, right? So if you think of some of the popular hip hop songs and artists and things like that of the 80s leading up to this, you know, where you had like Grandmaster Flash and, you know, I guess Sugar Hill Gang, and then and then the big ones like Run DMC and the Beastie Boys. You mentioned sort of like the denseness of this music. Those musically, those groups did not have that. Like,
no, not
there was
at
actually
all.
A lot of space, like sort of on purpose. And it was this sense of like, you know, it really started with the idea of like, we're just kind of like rapping over established records. That's where the whole sampling thing came from and all of that. You know, the whole two turntables and a microphone idea, right? You know, we're going to switch back and forth, but it's going to be in your mind, you're going to be very easily able to understand where this is going. Like, here's one record and we're rapping over that, and here's, and then we're switching over this other record, we're rapping over that. And even the, and it was, it had almost sort of a party mentality to it, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that, like, you know, it's a street party or whatever, and people are getting together and having a good time
for the
most part. And there may be some social commentary in there, but it wasn't necessarily like the driving force behind it, right? And then even the personalities of like Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, for example, they were groups. And maybe, you know, you sort of could, you know, you had, you know, Run and Daryl McDaniels and stuff like that, or the guys in the Beastie Boys, and maybe you identified with one or another, but they were all kind of like the same.
Yeah.
You know, they had the same sort of sensibilities, right? Mm-hmm. Or same kind of personalities, right, within that group.
Mm-hmm.
Public Enemy, though, was the classic sort of like mismatched partners kind of idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it worked so well.
It really
you
did.
You had Chuck D, the powerful, strong, you know, forceful.
Right. Black nationalist.
Right.
Yeah.
All of that. Mm-hmm. And then Flavor Flav is kind of like, they're a little bit sort of like for comic relief, right?
That's right.
And, you know, with the big clock and all that kind of stuff. And, but even like his delivery is so different, right?
It really is.
And the way that they would use him on most of the tracks, not all, as sort of like, I hate to say this, but it's like sort of the sidekick in a way that like Chuck is sort of the main guy.
Yeah, that's right.
He's saying things. And then Flavor Flav is coming in with just like little comments, little things like that. There's sort of an impish quality to him.
Absolutely.
But the other thing I noticed in listening to this again, though, is in a lot of ways, it's like, I it wouldn't work as well without him. It's almost like, in some ways, it's kind of like he's pushing Chuck, right?
That's right.
You know what I mean? He's sort of like this mischievous guy who's like, you know, because I mean, it's comic, but it's also intelligent in its own way. And it's almost like pushing Chuck to go further.
That's right. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I think that's a really well-made point, because I think without Flavor Flav, that Chuck is probably going to be too heavy and too intellectual to make it all work. And it's going to be too dense, and it's going to be really hard to pick it apart. But Flavor Flav does add those, yeah, boy, like those moments and telling you what time it is and all that stuff. That provided that space that allowed Chuck's ideas to breathe and the density of music to breathe at times. And became, you know, like their videos were awesome. And he was a great focal point in those videos too. You know, the two of them like right there together as
such
a duo.
Great chemistry, I think, that they had. But it wasn't all just those little affectations. Sometimes he'd come through with like a really killer line.
Yeah,
too,
you know, some really good raps on this record for sure.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you touched on it with those earlier groups, but I think the key thing here is the final song on It Takes a Nation of Millions, where they flip the whole idea on its head. Instead of, you know, they say their song is Party for Your Right to Fight. They weren't interested in partying. They were interested in fighting. And that kind of, you know, encapsulates what you said by flipping the whole Beastie Boys thing on its head.
Right. So I want to play a couple things real quickly here. So first of all, to give Flavor Flav some due, and I actually think it's really unfortunate, the image I think that people have of Flavor Flav today.
Yeah. I mean, he sort of became a little bit of a reality TV star.
That's
and
right.
Had some trouble with the law. Yeah.
It sort of became a parody of himself.
That's right.
Which is really unfortunate.
That's too bad.
But here's a track where he's a lead. Cold Lampin' with Flavor.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Yo, man. What do he mean by suckers, man? Yo, he only trying to put a black eye in the game. But yo, we gonna let you put a black eye in the game, boy. You know what I'm saying? Come to the payoff.
Okay, so I don't know if I quite completed the thought earlier. I was talking about the notion of the two turntables on a microphone and all that kind of stuff, and switching back and forth between records and or rapping over that. What I was really trying to get at here, and I think we've alluded to this, is, again, coming to the density of this, there's just when you think you sort of have a handle on what the song is, it switches, right? There's so much in this music that it almost kind of really just kind of blows you away.
Yeah, like it really what they does. Did here. Yeah. And I think, yeah, especially listening to that track, you hear those things in the background that sound like sirens.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that.
It really is a wake up call. Like it's an alarm. Like things are no longer the way they were before. Yeah. And it's like, you even hear it on Night of the Living Bassheads. You hear that siren, that explosion that's coming and like everybody run because it's all going down.
There's
now.
A few tracks where they use that effect, and I think you know, nowadays we look back and then go, oh yeah, that's just part of hip hop,
right?
But yeah, it gave it this real sense of urgency.
Absolutely,
this, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was just so fresh. And like you said, I think you said it really, really well, Jim. For somebody like myself who was into punk and Fugazi and things like that, they gave you this. They delivered the same buzz, like that same urgency and that same power that you really didn't hear anywhere else.
And this kind of became, to a large extent, the new sound of hip hop, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, you can definitely see,
I think you're right,
the influence definitely into the 90s.
Oh yeah.
With what happened, you know, there and you know, it became, you know, they accomplished the mission they set out to do, which again was to like raise the art form, to make it something to really be taken more seriously, to connect with listeners in a way that was more than just, you know, sort of, you know, having a good time. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, so this was Public Enemy's second album, as you mentioned, but then, you know, they had Fear of a Black Planet after that, which had Fight the Power, and then Apocalypse 91, I think, was the next one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that had, they re-recorded with Anthrax.
That's right,
on that
they
one,
did, yeah.
Bring the Noise.
That's right.
Bring the Noise from this album, Nation of Millions.
Yeah, one of their signature tunes. And also, you know, they, in some ways similar to Devo, I mean, they addressed the sort of the emptiness of modern life on this record, like She Watched Channel Zero and some of that stuff like that, you know, that was like you said, Chuck was really trying to rally his own people to, you know, like in Night of the Living Bassheads, brothers selling to one another, you know, selling to your own, rob a home, like drugs are destroying us, modern society is destroying us, and we got to get ourselves together if the revolution is ever going to take place.
So I mentioned Don't Believe the Hype is on this record. And Bring the Noise. Those are probably two of the biggest ones. You mentioned Party for Your Right to Fight.
Yep.
But, you know, another one that I think, you know, a lot of people would say was like really important in terms of a rap song was Rebel Without a Pause,
Oh, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So let's hear a little bit of that.
The rhythm, the rebel, without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhymer, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling, you know it's time again. Telling you to hear it, they praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show, bum rush the sound I made a year ago. I guess you know, you guess I'm just a radical, not on sabbatical, yes, to make it critical. The only part of your body should be party in two. Pass the power on the hour from the rebel to you.
Hey yo, Chuck, man, I don't understand this, man. Yo, you got to slow down, man, you're losing them.
Radio, suckers never play me on the mix. They just okay me now, knowing and growing. When the clock in my zone is known, sneaking and taking everything now the brother owns.
Hard.
My calling card, recorded and ordered. Supporter of Chess and Mart, loud and proud. Kicking live, next poet supreme. Loop for truth, bazooka for scheme.
Flavor.
A rebel in his own mind. Supporter of my rhyme, designed to scatter a line of suckers who claim I do crime. They are my time, dig it.
Okay, and it goes on. Like, that's like 5 minutes of just mostly just Chuck D, just
it's incredible,
just with just going, like there's no chorus to that, there's nothing, it just keeps going, right?
And I don't know if I had ever heard in my life up to this time anybody being so self-referential, like they were constantly recycling their own little themes and Bum Rush the Joe and like stuff from the last album and then the themes from before, and it was just kind of incredible the way he weaved those lyrics together. And you have to say a lot for the way he raps and puts all those word strings together in this record. It's really pretty amazing too.
But again, you can hear Flavor Flav coming in at the end of each verse, whatever, and telling him to like go further.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Like,
you know,
do it,
kick
Chuck.
It, you know, yeah right. You know, and so it just keeps building and building and building. It's a really a kind of an incredible song there. So
yeah, everything's amazing. Black Steel and the Arrow of Chaos is another one that's really incredible too. It's from start to finish, Jim. It's a stone cold classic. and you'll go on the internet and read a little bit about this album. There are many people who say it's the greatest hip hop album of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. I think you could make that argument.
And yet, even with the themes here and, you know, how much they were pushing the music and everything, I don't want to say this the right way. You can put this on, I think, you know, in just about any setting, mm-hmm. and I think people will get into it. It's not distracting in a way.
That's a good point.
That maybe some of the later stuff, some of the, you know, gangster rap and stuff like that, you got to be in the right frame of mind.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Say, like, you know, you can, there is a, even with everything this album is, there's still a certain accessibility to it in a weird way, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the great thing about it and great albums. It works for you like alone in your bedroom on the headphones and it's really stimulating. But yeah, in a social setting, like you said, it also works. And if you hear it like out at a bar or a club, it also works fantastically too. And you can sing along to it. I mean, I can remember our friends like in our stupid white suburban driving around doing every lyric of Night of the Living Bassheads, you know, like trading off all the parts and everything. Yeah.
It's weird. It's meant to be provocative, but it's not as in your face as you would think, mm-hmm. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
That's well said.
Yeah. All right. So that was pretty good. Those anniversaries, right?
That was some intense anniversaries. Some really, really important different records. Yeah. Really important.
All right. So let us know about any other albums you maybe we should talk about. We try to do these album anniversary shows in sort of like round numbers. So the 30th, the 40th anniversary, things like that. Yeah. But you know, is there anything from 1988, 1978, 1968, whatever, you know, let us know what you'd like, what really connects with you or what you think has stood the test of time. How about that?
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. You can do that by calling 612-440-1984. Email rock@suburbspod.com mm-hmm. or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at suburbspod. And please rate and review Rock in the Suburbs on Apple Podcasts.
Let's get to 100 reviews. That'd be awesome.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Next week, we'll be back with more. We don't know what.
No, we don't know what.
But it'll be something. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.
No.